This is the Medic Cast, October 6th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medic Cast. This is episode 138. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode of the show. Got a lot of great information coming up, including some good listener comments and emails, and one of them led us to our tip of the week this week, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few moments. I'd also like to welcome all of our brand new listeners. I know there's some of you out there, so you want to make sure that this is your first time listening to the show. Head over to the MedicCast site at MedicCast.com. That's the main MedicCast network site, and you'll find links to the MedicCast blog there, as well as links to our other shows in the network, and you'll find links to the show notes pages there as well. So you'll find all of that over at MedicCast.com. Just go to the MedicCast blog link there, and then you'll find your podcasts in the categories, and that's your show notes pages. I also want to welcome all of our long-term listeners, the members of the community that contribute, the comments, the suggestions, yeah, sometimes the corrections that help make this really a community effort, and I do appreciate all of your helpful hints, suggestions, and news links. It's all part of the community, and I really appreciate that. Of course, email is a great way to get a hold of us here at the Medic Cast, but it's also a great opportunity for you to head over and check out the Medic Cast forums at forums.mediccast.com. There's a lot of listeners over there participating. It's a great way to get your questions answered maybe a little bit more quickly and with some other points of view. It's also a great way for you to share your answers and comments and suggestions for other listeners, all available for you in the Medic Cast forums at forums.mediccast.com. I heard by email this week from our friend Jim Huffman over at EMS-safety.com. Jim and I have collaborated on a couple of different projects over there, and Jim offers a lot of great solutions for EMS training, and some of his paramedic training actually uses audio from this site to help you out in a video training format for your EMS paramedic and EMT skills stations for the National Registry. Jim was checking in with me. I have been posting videos periodically at paramedictv.com as well as YouTube and some other sites, and Jim noticed that one of the videos I uploaded, actually, the audio went garbled about 2 to 3 minutes into it, and it was fine on my end. Something happened during the upload, and he was happy to let me know that there was a problem. He was getting ready to comment and give me a thumbs up on that video, and I had to do some re-uploading till I could get the process to work the way it was supposed to. But I just wanted to thank Jim for taking care of that, and as a thank you to Jim, urge you to head over and check out his site over at EMS-safety.com. Jim's a good friend of the site here, and I always appreciate his helpful comments and tips on helping to support the Medic Cast, and there's no reason we can't support him as well. So check out some of the resources he has available over there. A lot of good stuff available from his site. Also, check out our videos as you find them posted. You know, if you search for Medic Cast or search for paramedic content, paramedic videos at some of the video sharing sites, you may find content from the Medic Cast. And even though they are shortened versions of the longer format videos in the Medic Cast Extra, I'd make sure that there's good content in there. I don't just believe in just throwing up infomercials. That's nobody likes that. And so you get good, solid content when I post these tip videos available for free. So you can find them and comment on them and help push some people back here to the Medic Cast site. It's a great way to support the Medic Cast. I also heard back from Jeff Guy. Jeff Guy is the physician who we've interviewed before. He's Burn Doc at burndoc.net, and he is also the guy who hosts the PHTLS podcast. He's getting ready to release a book, I think around the beginning of the new year, on pre-hospital pharmacology. So I've contacted Jeff, and he got back in touch with me, and hopefully he and I are going to get together here and do an interview segment talking about pharmacology for pre-hospital providers. And as soon as his book comes becomes available, I'll definitely provide a link for it here on the show so that you guys can check it out. I'm sure it's going to be great content. But Jeff was just checking in, and hopefully we'll maybe be able to feature him more frequently here in the coming months and into the coming new year. We can get him on here maybe two or three times a year to talk about EMS issues and talk about some of the things he does. He also has a great podcast for those of you that are trying to take your provider level and your medical knowledge to a new level. It's called the ICU Rounds podcast. If you search for Jeff Guy in the iTunes store, you'll find all of his podcast, but the ICU Rounds podcast is a great podcast for people that want to learn a little bit more in depth about topics like sepsis or falls or patients dealing with burns or the inflammatory response associated with different types of illnesses. All of that is readily available as part of Jeff's podcast, and I think you'll enjoy checking that out. I got an email also from our good friend and supporter of the show, Kelly. Kelly has checked in from time to time, and currently Kelly is expecting a child and is not right away this at this time EMTing, but loves listening to the show and keeping up to date on things. She recently had a diagnosis of SVT and wanted to find out a little bit more about what SVT means. So Kelly, guess what? We're going to go ahead and talk about SVT in today's tip and trick of the week. So hopefully that'll help you understand a little bit more. I've also provided some additional resource links in the show notes for you and, of course, for all the other providers out there that had a similar question, just didn't have it mean something quite so personally. So Kelly, thanks for keeping in touch with the show. And you've been a longtime supporter of the Medicast, and I greatly appreciate your efforts here, your comments and your suggestions and the links that you've sent to me. So keep up the good work, and good luck with your pregnancy. And hopefully everything stays safe and on even keel, and you'll learn a little bit more about SVT as you listen to this episode later on in the tip of the week. Time to jump on into this week's news stories. And I'm going to lead off with a story that I talked about briefly earlier in the week at the Medicast News podcast, which is our short midweek news program. And what I am talking about here is the crash of Maryland Trooper 2. Maryland's State Police Medevac Helicopter Service has been largely very safe and well-respected for its safety record and its record in patient care and transport. But unfortunately, Trooper 2 crashed last weekend, and there was, of course, it was a fatal crash. Most helicopter crashes are. Of the five people on board, including two patients, only one of the teenage patients from a motor vehicle accident survived the crash of the helicopter. Late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, they were flying a motor vehicle accident victims, a pair of them, back to Maryland Shock Trauma Center when they got into some pretty dense fog and needed to land their helicopter. They were heading towards Andrews Air Force Base, their home base, to land and be continuing the transport by their ground services, but they were unable to make it safely back to Andrews and crashed short of the landing field. It took about 90 minutes for them to actually find the helicopter. It crashed in a park in District Heights, Maryland, and when they did find the helicopter, the pilot, the flight paramedic trooper, and a provider from a local EMS service, plus one of the teen patients, were killed in the crash. And of course, the other patient was alive and was rushed to Shock Trauma for further care. This is, however, the eighth fatal medical helicopter crash in the past 12 months. And I've raised concerns about safety issues, not just in my local service, because I think that they're pretty safe service, but raising safety issues across the board on what we do to get medical patients to hospitals using aeromedical transport services, and what kind of oversight is there on these services. So that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit here. There is a National Transportation Safety Board investigation now ongoing, just based on the fact that there have been so many recent helicopter crashes. And the NTSB is looking into the accident, saying that they want to find out whether these lives were lost needlessly in these helicopter crashes. What was the cause of these crashes? What steps can be taken to further increase the safety of these helicopter crashes? And so, according to one quote from the NTSB vice chairman, Quote, the safety board is very concerned with the increasing number of these EMS helicopter accidents. We have had too many of them. The number is increasing. We need to do something about it. We need to do something about it right now. End quote. I couldn't agree more. And I called for this several months ago when there was that mid-air collision in Arizona between two different helicopters that were transporting near a hospital there. Seriously, folks, we need to look at the safety and efficacy of using helicopter transport when we can get those patients to definitive care in other ways. Obviously, there's a need for this. There's in many cases, though, we may not need to be using these services as much as we do, and there are other resources available. They're flashy, they're exciting, and certainly I like it because I'm in a rural part of Maryland that we have the troopers available to overcome our 45-minute to an hour transport time to the trauma center when they can get the patient there in 15 or 20 minutes. And that's what we need to do in some cases for seriously injured patients. But otherwise, we need to evaluate our patients carefully, make the determination of the most appropriate type of transport that is needed for that patient based on all of the factors involved, and then follow up with that decision and go ahead and move forward. So we need to look into this. Clearly, the NTSB is going to be releasing a report on it, and I'll be talking about that more as it develops. But I'd love to hear back from you. What has your experience been? What does your region do with medical helicopter transport, and how often is it used? Do you think that it's used too frequently, or do you think that it's not used enough? These are going to be questions that are going to be asked across the board. We've had a lot of editorials recently on different blogs, websites, and in magazines on this particular topic. And I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say as the listeners here to the MedicCast. There's two stories I linked to this week on it, one on the helicopter crash and one on the NTSB investigation. I urge you to check those out. They're both from over at emsresponder.com, and see what you think based on those two articles. Next up in the news, as we move forward from that talk about helicopter crashes, let's talk a little bit about how we do our physical exams and high-tech answers to physical exam. First of all, I hear a lot of questions and concerns from especially rural areas and less well-funded EMS services that they need new gadgets, they need new items to help them better assess their patients. And when this comes down to needing heart monitors because they don't have a recently produced heart monitor, when they need updated AEDs for their units, that's one thing. That's a different kind of need and technology. But when you're asking for new gadgets that perform a job that you can do yourself with a good physical exam, that may not be as necessary. Sure, it's nice, but sometimes you can become too reliant on these extra technology devices and lose some of your skills in assessing the patient through traditional means. There's a recent study that came out that looked at the comparison between a good solid physical exam and patient history, and comparing that to the evaluations performed by high-tech imaging studies and lab studies and things like that on assessing the level of a patient's congestive heart failure. And what they found in this study was that even though doctors have really started to lean heavily on these electronic and high-tech diagnostic techniques, that they are able to get just as good of an answer through a good physical exam and adequate and accurate patient history. And when they do this, they are able to get just as good a result as the high-tech answers did. And this is important to recognize because, first of all, these extra tests cost a lot of extra money, and a doctor can use their own physical assessment skills to get the same answer for, what, half the price, a quarter of the price of those high-tech, expensive diagnostic tools? Doesn't mean that there isn't a place for those diagnostic tools in some situations, but I know from my experience looking at working in a hospital that doctors rely very heavily on, instead of just doing a physical exam, to back up their physical exam with a high-tech option that costs thousands of dollars. Why do we need to have a CT on a patient that you've already determined is not suffering from any kind of head injury? Yeah, I guess it's to save you from getting sued for that 1 in 1,000 subdural bleed that you end up having, but you know, there are history factors that can lead you in that direction that you can rule out and send a patient home confidently. And this is the same that appears to be true based on this study when assessing the level of a patient's heart failure, the amount of fluid accumulation that the patient has. So I think this is a good resource for us to look at and think about our own physical assessment skills. You know, we rely on automatic blood pressure machines, and they are great tools and resources to have, but have you checked that patient's blood pressure manually to be sure that it's in the proper range? If you're getting an unusual reading on that automatic blood pressure, are you double checking to make sure that you're getting a good reading? You know, those are things that you need to do. You need to use your tools appropriately, but back them up with your own empirical assessment. And that's something that you can do in many cases in the field very well and very accurately. And you need to rely on those skills that you learned in your EMTB class or your paramedic program. Rely on learning and assessing and practicing those skills so that if you have a failure of a piece of equipment, you still know that you can get the answer to your questions using good old-fashioned assessment techniques. Check out this article, read a little bit more on it. There is a lot of information on what specifically they did at the article's main page, and you can find that link to in the main article that I've put on the website. Next up, I'm going to move into a story from MarketWatch.com. Yes, I said MarketWatch.com. Not something you'd expect to hear here on the Medicast, but they had a great article that they put up there talking about the recent cardiac arrest study that was released. Now, we talked about this a little bit last week. One of the things that this study does is it shows different areas of the country how effective their region is in cardiac arrest survival rates. And we've talked that to death. I know Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal podcast has talked about this issue. You can hear his take on it as well over at his site. But one of the things that I didn't think about was how this cardiac arrest study can help overcrowding ERs and overtaxed EMS crews that are running too many calls. When we access ALS care in the field, most of our first-line interventions for these patients are interventions that are the same interventions that would be performed in the emergency room. It's one of the reasons that when ALS care arrives on the scene, they often will stay in play for a little while with a cardiac arrest patient because we are going to be taking the same interventions. And those interventions are more important than taking a pause in care and getting that patient loaded onto the ambulance. So that's something that, you know, we hold off on in some cases when we have an opportunity to get some interventions in place and moving right away. We don't want to stop good CPR to put a patient into an ambulance when we still have the opportunity to try to get them back to a shockable rhythm. That's something that ALS care focuses on when we have cardiac arrest. But once we've taken those first line steps, the same that the ER takes, what is the survival rate when we don't have a response to those interventions? Well, it's extremely low. And what this article is saying is that why are we tying up resources, transporting a dead patient to the emergency department where they're going to be pronounced as soon as we arrive? We've taken the steps we need to take. Nothing else we're going to do is going to make a difference. Even if we get them to a different location for different interventions, they have been down too long. And we're not going to change what we do in our initial ACLS interventions because those are the same, very same things that they would do in the emergency department. And there's a disconnect there. Once we reach a certain point, these patients have extremely low survival rates. If there's been no response or no return of spontaneous circulation in the scene at all, there is very unlikely that we're going to see that change when we get to the emergency department or en route to the emergency department. So what this article is basically proposing is that EMS crews, based on certain criteria found in this cardiac arrest study, along with their online medical control, could make determinations to cease resuscitation efforts in the field and stop putting our lives at risk running a cardiac arrest to the hospital when we end up being more at risk for motor vehicle accidents when we're running those calls and all of those other things. We can leave the patient at the scene, call the coroner, have them come out and make the final pronouncement and go ahead and take over. without having to risk additional transport to the hospital, tying up ER people that are going to crowd around being ready to work a cardiac arrest only to have that called after a few minutes of some initial efforts. This is something that's controversial and is going to be looked at in region by region basis. But I found it interesting that, first of all, it was at marketwatch.com. But second of all, that this particular story was looking at this study in such a way that it would make a decision for some areas. I mean, 99.8% of these patients that don't have that don't meet the criteria are going to remain dead and are not going to have any further care performed, even if they do get to the hospital. All they're going to do is tie up a bed, tie up staff, and tie up EMS crews that could be used in other locations. So check out this article. It's very well written and a very interesting look at some of these particular issues. For this week's tip of the week, we're going to be talking about SVT, or supraventricular tachycardia. This is a continuation of our ongoing ACLS review here on the MedicCast, and it was brought up, as I said earlier, by an email from a listener, Kelly, who talked about being recently diagnosed with SVT, despite being relatively young and unhindered by any other cardiac problems. To have a sudden diagnosis like this to a person who's otherwise pretty healthy is of concern. And so it's important for all of us, whether you're an ALS or a BLS provider, to learn a little bit about this particular condition. Now, you might see this presented in a number of different ways under a lot of different names. SVT, PSVT for paroxysmal. Paroxysmal basically means sudden onset. And that's one of the things that is characterized by SVT. You can be walking along and have a completely normal heartbeat and suddenly have a paroxysmal SVT episode. And this is that sudden onset of this extremely rapid heart rate. You'll also hear it called multifocal atrial tachycardia. You might hear it called AFib or a flutter based upon what people are looking at, because it does tend to bounce around the atria and you get a multifocal or multi-shape appearance to your cardiac rhythm. It also could be called something like a conduction pathway disturbance or abnormality. And this is because it's based upon the electrical system in the heart normally follows a certain pathway. However, sometimes that main pathway, you know, picture your overhead wiring on your telephone poles. You know, sometimes that branches out to poles on the other side of the road. Well, that's supposed to be a single path for like a local series of houses, but imagine what would happen if every now and then the main current path got diverted to that other side of the road so that it didn't go through the normal pathway. So the current's now passing through this small neighborhood that's not used to having that type of current and then comes out the other side and jumps back onto the regular pathway. This is what happens in SVT. You have kind of this return loop that can cause an issue when patients are having an otherwise normal heart, they can experience somehow the electrical system jumping the track periodically and causing an extremely rapid heart rate because of this feedback loop where the electricity jumps off the track, goes through the atria, comes back in at the top again, and reinitiates the whole process. And when that happens very quickly, you get heart rates 200, 250 beats per minute based on an extremely fast atrial rate. And when that happens, that atrial rate causes a fast ventricular response, and you end up with people having a heart that's beating so fast that it can't adequately refill with fluid before the next beat. And you start having reduced cardiac output, hypotension, and ultimately cardiac arrest if you don't get ahead of the game and treat this very carefully. Unlike our normal sinus tachycardia being a normal sinus rhythm that is too fast, it is greater than 100 beats per minute, you usually only see your sinus tachs start getting up into the 140, 150, 160 range, depending on what your protocol says. Anything faster than, say, 170 or so is going to be starting to look like it's going to be an SVT based upon one of these accessory conduction problems. And you'll see rates getting up into 200, 250, 300 beats per minute in the atrial, on the atrial side. And this can be, as I said, extremely dangerous for the patient. They'll start experiencing shortness of breath. They'll start experiencing chest pain. And this is something that will not resolve like some other cardiac problems where if someone rests, it'll get better. This is where the electricity has started a feedback loop and can't resolve it on its own. So there are special treatments that are involved with this particular problem. Also seen is what's known as an AV reentrant tachycardia. And this is where there's a reentry of splitting and reentry of the electrical signal at the AV node. And this is where there actually is a separate accessory pathway that extends into the ventricles. This is characterized by a very short P to R interval and a sloped beginning of the QRS wave, that delta wave that you see, that sloped wave that going into the QRS complex. And this is commonly thought to be related to what's called Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, WPW syndrome, and it is also considered to be a form of SVT. Finally, there is another condition called junctional ectopic tachycardia. This is a rare cause of SVT, usually following a surgical intervention for another cardiac problem. So unlike the other SVTs that happen in otherwise healthy people, this is something that actually is probably caused by a surgical side effect and sometimes seen in younger people who have had congenital heart surgery. Children following repair of a heart defect can sometimes show this, but usually this is found in older individuals. And this is a separate type of a reentry of that splitting of the electrical signal and a reentry of it in a different location. So what about patients who have PSVT or SVT? What are we going to commonly see here? Well, SVT has a sudden onset. It may last for just a few seconds. It may last for hours or days. These patients may or may not be symptomatic for any other problems. So this is one of those treat the patient, not the monitor situations. You certainly don't want to cardiovert somebody just because they're in a non-symptomatic SVT. This is something of concern, but you don't just go ahead and put the pads on them and shock them and try to cardiovert them just because the monitor looks bad. You want to monitor these patients, you want to make sure you adequately assess them, and then you want to get them to an appropriate facility where this can be examined by a cardiologist. However, about one-third of patients with standard SVT will experience some side effects and symptoms associated with it. This includes syncopal episodes, shortness of breath, chest pain, signs of heart failure, pulmonary edema, up to myocardial infarction and cardiac arrest. And so you need to make sure that you're assessing your patients completely. As we said earlier, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome are at greater risk for cardiac arrest based on the fact that because the pathway actually converts and heads down to the ventricles, there can actually be a very rapid response. And in cases where these patients develop AFib or a flutter, this can cause this ventricular feedback to rapidly become ventricular fibrillation. And of course, that will cause a sudden cardiac arrest. So you need to be aware of that. Look for your short P to R intervals and delta waves. Of course, in a very rapid rhythm, you're not going to be able to adequately see your P waves, but it's something to keep an eye on if you can slow that rhythm down somehow. So what are we going to do as far as treating these patients? Well, one of the things you need to do is get a quick and adequate history. Has this patient been diagnosed with SVT before? If they have, what's worked for them in the past? Because generally, when you find out what works for them in the past, you'll know where you're heading. Doesn't mean you don't take your other interventions in appropriate order, but if you know that these people need to be cardioverted nearly every time they have an episode of SVT, you're going to get your pads out and be ready to cardiovert these patients when you've reached that point in your process. You can consult and find out if you want to go right to cardioversion, but you know what? I don't want to shock people that don't otherwise need to be shocked, and we can take other steps if necessary. Our common symptoms include feelings of palpitations. Most patients that have SVT experience this racing heart rate, and they call it palpitations. They say they can feel their heart beating, thumping in their chest, racing. Dizziness, shortness of breath, syncopal episodes, chest pain, also general fatigue, diaphoresis, and nausea. And of course, diaphoresis and nausea is because we have a cardiogenic shock onset going on. There could be anything that could set off an SVT episode. Again, get a good history, find out what they were doing, and then pass that information along. Perhaps the cardiologist can adequately assess what is causing these episodes in these patients. Once you've found out that you've got an SVT and it's symptomatic, you want to go ahead and get your interventions in place. Obviously, this is a cardiac patient, and you want to get O2, IV, and monitor right away so that you can adequately assess the patient. If they are hemodynamically unstable, signs of extreme hypotension, signs of deteriorating condition, altered mental status, pulmonary edema, these are signs of hemodynamic compromise, you're going to want to progress right away to cardioversion. Of course, follow your own protocols, but that's what my cardioversion protocols say, so we're going to go with those. If the patient is otherwise relatively stable, in other words, they have some signs and symptoms of distress, maybe some shortness of breath and onset of chest pain, but they are not showing signs of hemodynamic compromise, the pulmonary edema, altered mental status, extremely low blood pressure, you're going to want to go ahead and get an IV started and move on to our other steps. These include having the patient take vagal maneuvers. Vagal maneuvers are we're going to bear down. We're going to try to stimulate the vagal nerve, the vagus nerve, that 10th cranial nerve, and that's going to stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is going to cause the heart rate to slow down. So have the person bear down as if they're having a strong bowel movement. Somebody once told me, have them stick their thumb in their mouth and pretend like they're blowing on it like it's a trumpet. Blow really hard against their thumb as if they were blowing on a horn, and use that back pressure to put additional pressure on the vagus nerve. So these are things, a cold ice water to the face. A lot of these people are going to do these to themselves because they are used to treating this condition, and they're going to try these other steps. They'll dunk their head in a tub of ice water. These things also will cause that vagal stimulation. These Valsalva maneuvers, the bearing down like you're having to go to the bathroom. However, if these don't work, you can move on to our medication option, which is adenosine. We'll be talking about adenosine in a little bit as our med of the week, but you would administer adenosine rapid IV push close to the heart in an IV location as close to the heart as possible, and you're going to follow that with a flush to go ahead and get it into place, and you can follow up with additional doses per protocol. And then, of course, our final step is to use synchronized cardioversion. If this does not work, we're going to have to consult medical control for additional doses of adenosine or additional cardioversion steps, but these are our follow-up steps. This is what we do for SVT. Many people are able to manage their SVT themselves using these Valsalva maneuvers, these vagal maneuvers that are able to put the brakes on and reset the heart. But on those cases where they don't, they need to call us, and we need to be prepared to recognize and treat this as well. There's some great links in the show notes, both a great article over at emedicine.com that I found on PSVT, and also an article over at the National Institutes of Health Medline Service generally on different arrhythmias and their treatments. I also would urge you, if you're a Medicast Extra member, there'll be some additional links for you over there and some additional resources. Our med of the week this week, as I said earlier, is going to be adenosine. Adenosine is our primary medication treatment for SVT. And when we see supraventricular tachycardias that are not hemodynamically compromised, we want to avoid cardioverting these patients, avoid shocking those patients that would otherwise mind being shocked, is the way it's always been put to me. Adenosine is a naturally occurring nucleoside. We have adenosine in our bodies all the time. If you know and review your cellular biology, it's an active part of our energy storage process. It is used to treat patients with a narrow complex tachycardia like PSVT or WPW, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. What it does is it slows conduction through the AV node, so it actually is going to slow down the pace of what's getting through to the ventricles. It does not affect ventricular contractility or action. It just merely slows the progression of the signals to the ventricles. It also can cause some peripheral vasodilation, and this can be sometimes dramatic, so you need to be prepared for somebody to become very flushed very suddenly because of this vasodilation that occurs. People are going to feel hot, get suddenly sweaty. It's very uncomfortable to patients to receive this particular drug because of the way it makes them feel briefly. And I say briefly because this medication gets used up very quickly. Its onset of action is 15 to 20 seconds following its dose rapid IV push, and rapid because the half-life of this medication is only 10 seconds. That means 10 seconds after you push this drug, only half of the drug is left in the system. It is rapidly broken down in the bloodstream. So you need to administer this in an IV port as close to the heart as possible, and you need to have like a 20 cc flush ready to go right behind the administration of this drug. When you give the dose, you're going to have two syringes ready to go. You may even have, if you have two close ports on your IV tubing, you're going to want to have your adenosine screwed in, your flush screwed in, and then you're going to push the adenosine and push the flush and open your IV fluids up briefly to get that adenosine into the bloodstream and up into towards the heart as quickly as possible. Indications for the use of adenosine include to slow the rate of any narrow complex tachycardia. It's only effective on SVT or PSVT because it doesn't have any effect on the ventricles. So if you have a ventricular tachycardia, this is not going to have any effect on it. So if you have a narrow complex tachycardia that does not respond at all to adenosine, even briefly, you're probably looking at a VTAC situation that you're not reading correctly. And you need to kind of reevaluate, get your 12 leads lined up again and take a look at your rate and your rhythm. It will not also affect AFib or A-flutter. So this is not going to have the same effect as administering something like diltiazem, you know, that calcium channel blocker. This is only going to slow down the conduction rate between the atria and the ventricles through the AV node. AFib and A-flutter will not be affected because you're still going to have that rapid atrial rate. In stable wide complex tachycardias for pediatric patients, in some situations, this may be indicated, and you should follow your own protocols on that. The only contraindication for this drug is known hypersensitivity to adenosine, and that's because everybody has adenosine in their body. It's part of our cellular makeup, so this is not something we're likely to see, but they may be allergic to the particular formulation of this med, and usually this will be a patient who has an existing SVT who'll tell you, I can't take adenosine, in which case, guess what? They go right to the cardioversion with medical consult. Adverse effects, we talked about this already, flushing, shortness of breath, chest pressure and pain, nausea, headache, dizziness, and hypotension. One thing to remember in this med, and this is the thing that's freaked me out the first time I gave this drug, and I knew it, but I wasn't really expecting it to be as dramatic as it was. But this drug can cause up to 40 seconds of asystole. Are you listening? This is going to stop the heart in some cases for up to 40 seconds. It doesn't just slow down the AV conduction rate. In some cases, it's at least going to stop it, even if it stops it for like 5 or 10 seconds, but it could stop it for longer than that. And when a person's heart stops beating and their lungs stop getting blood flow, they know it. And they become very distressed, anxious, and uncomfortable. Prepare your patients for the fact that they are going to feel a little anxious, that this drug may feel weird when it's administered, and they may feel strange, but that you're right there with them and you're prepared to help them out. If you have this happen and this asystole does not resolve on its own for some reason, you need to be prepared. You should already have your cardioversion pads out anyway. You may be prepared to have to pace this patient. So, you know, you're going to want to have your pads nearby and ready to go anyway, but be prepared for the unlikely occurrence that this might actually cause a longer term asystolic situation. Dosing for patients is, for an adult patient, I always remember adenosine 6-12-12. And that's because you're going to give 6 milligrams rapid IV push. And if there's no response, 2 minutes later, give 12 milligrams. And in another 2 minutes, give another 12 milligrams if there's no response to the previous dosing. Okay. So 6-12-12 is generally the adult dosing criteria. And that seems to be pretty standard. That's ACLS standard. Even though I'm using Maryland protocols here, this is a pretty standard dosing situation. pediatric patients. 0.1 milligrams per kilogram is our pediatric dose for this particular drug, and up to the adult maximum, up to 6 milligrams. And then the secondary dose would be 0.2 milligrams per kilogram, and that's IV, IO. And again, remember, you're going to have a single maximum dose for that. That second and third dose is going to be 12 milligrams. So you never give more than the adult normal dose, but you could give up to that adult dose in the pediatric dosing guidelines. So that's our adenosine. Again, remember, it's very important to give this rapid IV push, to put a flush in right behind it, to push it into the venous system and get it up towards the heart as quickly as possible. This is especially true if you're using an IO insertion. You want to make sure that you're flushing, getting as close to the heart as possible, as quickly as possible, because of the short half-life of this drug. So that's a look at adenosine. Remember, refer to your own protocols and guidelines whenever possible. This is for general purposes only. You need to follow up with your own protocols. And guess what, folks? That's it. We're going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast right there. I want to thank all of you for listening to the show this week. And make sure you head over and check out the links to the articles and additional resources that I've placed in the show notes for this episode. Go to mediccast.com/blog. That's the main blog page. And in the categories section for podcasts, you'll find the show notes for this and every other episode of the MedicCast, so you can go back and check out past episode links as well. If you haven't already done so and would like to get in touch with me, please do so. I love to hear from the listeners, as you can tell from my recounting of listener email every week. It's great to hear from you and hear your comments and suggestions and links and sometimes corrections. I make mistakes, folks, just like everybody else, and this is a community effort, so you got to keep me straight. Send me email to podmedic@mac.com. That's podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line. We haven't had a voicemail call in a couple of weeks. Is that next voicemail call going to be from you? If so, call 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Put that one in your cell phones, folks, and when you're listening to the show, you can call in and leave a message over at the voicemail line. If you're on Skype, you can get a hold of me on the Skype system at PodMedic and leave a voicemail there. And also, I'm now currently on Twitter, so if you're following any Twitter feeds, you can look for the Twitter feed under PodMedic, and I will be putting up Twitter posts periodically. Don't forget to support the MedicCast forums. If you haven't already checked it out, it's free to join, free to be a member over there, and a great way for you to communicate with other listeners to the show, share your photos, share your videos, share a whole lot more questions and answers just for each other over at the MedicCast forums at forums.mediccast.com. Also, GoDaddy.com, use your promo codes to get 10% off and get your own piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. All right, enough of me, folks. We're going to go ahead and head on out here and wrap up with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week, we'll have a song from Laura Clapp. Laura has played some music here on the show before, and we're happy to have some of her songs back on here again. This is Hey Hey Sister. If you like what you hear, head over to Laura's website and let her know you heard it here on the MedicCast. All right, that's it for me. Enough of this chit-chat. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Want to see you all again here next week. In the meantime, don't forget, scene safety, BSI.
Half asleep, just sent a bad decision home. Quick to anticipate which body part she hates while she puts her fake eyelashes on. Every morning, same reaction. Absolute unsatisfaction. Just the product of the world and a rush. This crazy life we live. wolf attack. Can't do this, can't do that. Or she might lose her precious friends. Watch your figure, watch your weight. Clean off that empty plate. Girl, you know that ain't no way to live. Time for social need.